Welcome back to another episode of Hooked on Score. I'm your host, Rick Urban, and we have something a little different for you today. Normally on Hooked on Score, we focus on composers, but we have Alexandra Eckhart, who is a music supervisor. I wanted to give you guys a little in-depth look into the process of being a music supervisor and everything that that entails. Alexandra is originally a bass player. She has played with a number of different Broadway shows, and she has been on the Tonight Show and things like that. But she also recently was the music supervisor for a Sundance film called Passing. This is written and directed by Rebecca Hall, who is most well known as an actress. She was in The Town and The Prestige, an amazing actress. And I believe this is her first, her directorial debut. This film stars Tessa Thompson and Alexander Skarsgård. So without further ado, let's bring in Alexandra, who we just discussed, and she likes to go by Alex. So we're going to go by Alex for the course of this interview. Hello, Alex. How are you?
Hello, Rick, or shall I say Richard, whatever you like to be called. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Thanks for being here. Like I said, we normally talk to composers, but it's been something that I wanted to do for a while, is to bring on a music supervisor, because so many people, even composers, even in the film world, people don't really know where score ends and where music supervision picks up, or how they cross and everything like that. So I want to get into all that with you. But before that, I kind of wanted to start with a little bit about your background, because I think you originally started as a bassist. Is that right?
Yeah. I've played bass since I was around 8 years old. Both my parents are bass players, so that was the family biz, you could say. But yeah,
you say both of your parents are bass players?
I know. It's
wow.
It's my dad plays electric and electric guitar, and my mom plays upright bass and cello, and it's a little partridge family of bassists, I guess.
And were they professional bass players, or did they just do it on the side?
Yeah, no, they went to school for it. They met at music school, and now they're both music teachers in the same district in Connecticut, and they teach jazz and orchestra and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, no, they're both amazing musicians, so I learned a lot from them. I was very lucky, yeah.
So did you grow up in Connecticut?
I did, yeah. Connecticut through and through. I went to UConn for jazz school, and then I moved to New York. I did a couple Broadway tours, and I've done a lot of Broadway shows as a bass player and just played with different artists and all around New York, and just traveling and touring and session work and playing with a lot of composers on the Broadway scene. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. But
it says here that you've worked with Sarah Bareilles and Lin-Manuel Miranda. It says you've played a couple performances of Hamilton. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, actually, my first professional gig was doing the touring company of In the Heights. So right out of school, about a month out of school, I auditioned for this tour. And it was really awesome to get to work with Lin and work with Alex Lacamoire, who's now just everywhere working on Fosse Verdon and Hamilton. And he's just the most talented. But yeah, and I've subbed at Hamilton in the pit since it opened. So I guess that's 5 or something years ago. And it's super, super fun. I mean, the music's obviously amazing, and it's amazing to be a part of that. So, and yes.
In the Heights isn't In the Heights is not an easy musical to get your feet wet over.
I mean, it's all different kind of Latin grooves and mixed with hip hop and, but yeah, a lot of salsa and bachata. And I learned all the different claves and everything getting to do that. But I loved that music. That was such a fun book to play. And it was a 9-month tour. So we were just going across America and playing this show that was about like urban people. So we would sometimes be in like tiny little towns who not are not familiar with that music, and it could be pretty entertaining at
They're
times.
Clutching their pearls. Oh my, what's going on?
Exactly. Well, I mean, even after that, I did the Book of Mormon tour. So imagine how that was received in like Salt Lake City or various other places where they thought it was legitimately preaching the Book of Mormon. And even though on the ticket it says like not suitable for under whatever the age. Yeah. But yeah, so.
I remember I was in a touring production of American Idiot. The Green Day musical.
Yeah.
And at one point, and it's Green Day, so like parents brought their kids and everything like that. And then in this production, there was, after they just shot up heroin, they were having sex on stage. And this mother like grabbed her children and was like, "We are leaving right now."
It's so wholesome like, though. It's such a family show. Yeah, it was funny. We had Matt and Trey with us when we were rehearsing and getting the production up and running. And the way they approach it is, if nobody walks out in at least every show, then we're not doing our jobs right. So that was a funny way to look at it.
Yeah. No, it's such a... I like that when they do stuff, they really do it. This is the creators of South Park, of course, also created Book of Mormon. And it's a pretty intense musical when you go into it not knowing anything. Luckily, I think everybody at this point kind of knows what they're expecting when going into it. But
at that time, not.
Oh, so this was right when it first came out, so people didn't really know what to expect.
Yeah, exactly. So I think in New Orleans, we played a show, and this was kind of well into the tour, but 70 people walked out in one show. So that was our record. But
wow.
Yeah, no, both of those shows were super fun to tour with. And I mean, the music's just so like genre changing, like playing all the South African kind of score and fretless bass for Book of Mormon. And then it had some metal stuff. And yeah. I just loved getting to play all the different genres. And
so when you're doing that, so how do you do it every night, the same thing? How does that, because I have a little experience with this, but usually, you know, it's over a 2 or 3 week run of doing, and then we change up shows where, you know, you're doing the same show every night. How do you keep it fresh? I mean,
that is the question, really. I mean, if you're doing it for years on end and you're doing 8 shows a week and you can't really call out unless you're on your deathbed, basically. But you just have to find your certain moments that are fun and that you look forward to. And hopefully you get some kind of freedom to mess around and put your personality into the book. And with those shows in particular, also it was fun because they're lighthearted and they're fun and they're really awesome music that you can dance to. So the crowds would just like love it. And that we kind of fed off of that and fed off the actors. And it was exciting, you know, it was a really cool experience.
Yeah. It helps that it's an interesting modern musical too. Whereas if you're, you know, you're playing Oklahoma for literally the 30th year, you know, in that production or something like that, that's going to kind of draw on. But Book of Mormon, you can keep listening to over and over again and still enjoy. So you've also done a lot of work on the different Tonight shows. I see you've been on the Tonight Show and the Colbert Show and things like that. Was that with Sarah Bareilles or was that a different project?
Yeah, I actually played a couple of gigs with Sarah. We did we premiered her new song at the time, Armor, on Colbert, which was amazing because she had just done the album with T-Bone Burnett, who is like an icon, and I just admire his work so much on all the films that he's worked on. But we kind of made it our own. We had two drummers, which was great. I'd never played with two drums before, but it was awesome. And we were all singing and just collaborating and getting our own kind of feel for the song. And I mean, playing on late night shows and all those shows are always really exciting, but Sarah's just so crazy talented and weirdly the most normal person you've ever met. So she's just super fun, super quick, and I just adore her. And yeah, that was an amazing experience. Yes. We actually also played at the Museum of Natural History in, you know, that huge room with the giant whale.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing.
We played directly underneath it. So it was a bit of a safety hazard, but it was...
So there's some acoustics to deal with. How is the sound bouncing off the whale?
Exactly. Exactly. But
wow. Yeah, she's one of those people where I love it when people that have broken big and made it famous have the goods for real. Like, you know, like you can put her in any room with any singers.
Oh, my God.
And she shines through. So
her ears are also insane. Like, we were trying to get these harmonies together, and she just hears everything, which... It is like, I just respect that so much. She's just so talented. Yeah.
So you've done all this Broadway and, oh God, I'm sorry. I have to talk about this before we get into Passing. I have to, it's the last, literally the last line on your bio.
Oh, no.
It's a little thing that's thrown in there. It says you got to work on Bat Out of Hell with Jim Steinman. Is that the musical production of Bat Out of Hell?
It is the musical version. I'm so glad you brought that out because I just love, yeah, that was one of like the peaks of my gigging life. I had no idea I loved Meatloaf so much until I got to play that.
Where was that? Was that in UK or in Broadway or where?
That was Broadway. That was a production two summers ago, I guess, at City Center. And it was a very strange show. But the music,
good.
Yeah, as it should be. I mean, truly.
Yes.
But the music was exactly like the record. So, they didn't show tunify it at all. It was exactly like Paradise by the Dashboard Light, the entire thing, that whole baseball kind of segment.
Cow.
It was, I lived my best life. It was so much fun.
It's so funny. It's been a little, It's so funny. It's been many years now. I've been trying to see this musical. I am one of the biggest Meatloaf fans there is, and a Jim Steinman. He's probably my favorite songwriter. And I heard about this musical a couple years ago. And when I heard about it, it was a transitioning out of Broadway. And you could only see it in, I think, London, or not even in London, kind of off London. So we're going to fly to London to go see it, blah, blah, blah. Didn't happen. And then finally, I'm based in Miami, and they were touring through Miami last April.
Mm-hmm.
So right after everything shut down. So I literally have a ticket to the Bat Out of Hell musical on my wall, but the show got canceled because of COVID. And now I still haven't seen it. And it's like, it's going to be my life goal to finally see that musical.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. Yeah, it's actually really... I can tell a quick Meatloaf story if you'd like, but
we could spend this entire interview talking about
Meatloaf
stories if you want.
I'll tell a quick story and then we'll get on to the film. But, so Meatloaf, he came to the opening night, right? So we were all stoked, like Meatloaf. And afterwards we went up to take a picture with him and he looked around at the band and he just goes, where's the bass player? And I was just like, it's me. And he was like, well, me, you sounded amazing. So I don't know if I can swear on that, but that's verbatim what he said.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if I could put that quote up on, I should put that on my website, truthfully. That's one of the highlights of my career.
Meatloaf approved. You can put Meatloaf approved. That's
exactly. Meatloaf confirmed. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I've literally driven from Chicago to Youngstown, Ohio to see through a snowstorm to see Meatloaf. So I could geek out with you on Meatloaf all day, but instead
we'll get back to that later.
We are going to move on to Passing.
Yes.
So I do want to get into that, but before we do that, I want to let our listeners know that we are now on Patreon. So what does that mean? Well, you go to patreon.com, patreon.com/hookedonscore. So you can find our Patreon page and you can help us out by subscribing to the show. What does that mean? For as little as $1 per month, you can help support the show, keep these guests coming, keep us going, talking about different film scores. For the $5 level, you guys are going to get bonus episodes We're going to do exclusive members-only episodes, as well as video reviews of different film scores. There's going to be a lot of cool stuff in the works. And like I said, it's not that much. I know it's a rough time. Everybody's broke, but you're going to get extra content. So if you go to patreon.com/hookedonscore, again, patreon.com/hookedonscore, and you can support the show. So how did you come about being a music supervisor? But before we get into that, can you give us, and I know this is probably impossible to do, a short description of what a music supervisor does on a film? We all know that the composer writes the score, right, for the film. What role does the music supervisor have on a film?
Yeah, so that's, I mean, the age-old question. It's kind of something that you don't really figure out until you're doing it, I think, because it can just be, it can change from project to project, and it can just be very nebulous, and every project has its own kind of tasks to it, to the job. But for passing, I mean, it's basically, in general, it's looking over and overseeing all of the music-related aspects to the film or production. So, yeah, so my approach for passing was like reading through the script, talking to the director, Rebecca, about her vision for the film, working with the composer and kind of overseeing that, and if he needed to contract any musicians or rent any gear or any studio time, anything like that, kind of coordinating that with other source music that we wanted to use in the film, which we had a lot of, and I'm sure I'll talk to you about that, all the layers of our score, which is really interesting. But in addition to working with the composer, it's pitching music for certain scenes, kind of researching rights and researching the history of it. In this case, it's, the film takes place in 1929, so it's a very specific era of jazz and Harlem Renaissance especially. It's such an interesting transition kind of period between Chicago blues and New Orleans jazz, like brass jazz, into swing slowly. So it was awesome getting to research that and kind of go deep diving through old periodicals and Billboard charts and Duke Ellington records and all sorts of things like that. So a music supervisor, basically just all of those things encompassed. I mean, it can really be anything. I mean, again, on this, there was a lot of extra fun projects. Like, I produced these sessions for pre-records for an on-camera performance, which was really fun, and then re-recorded more footage for that. I edited some of the audio for that with our music editor, Chad Birmingham, who's amazing, and we did that all remotely in the pandemic, as if it wasn't hard enough. Yeah.
Yeah, that's just another challenge that you have to do for something like that.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. That must have been...
Yeah, it's one thing if you can just book a studio and take an hour and meet in wherever and record. Yeah. But if you're doing it remotely and having everyone do it and then matching it to the picture, it can be kind of insane. But yeah, no, so music supervision can be really anything.
So are you mainly reporting to the director, or are you reporting to producers, or how does that work? What's the sort of chain of command, if you will?
Right. Well, no, it's an interesting question, kind of seeing who you report to. So I was in constant talks with Rebecca. She has like such a vision for this film, and she has such eclectic music taste. She knows so much about it. So we really tried to get to build like a sonic world for this film. And so I would be in discussions with her and the producers, and I worked with the composer, music editor, but ultimately, yeah, Rebecca, I would run everything past her, and we would just have a dialogue and collaborate on all the different musical elements.
And this is her directing debut,
mm-hmm.
But just watching her as an actor, you kind of can tell there's more going on there. I could see how she would be an amazing director. And Tessa Thompson, I mean, that's two of my favorite actors in Hollywood are involved in this film right off the bat. So I feel like it's going to be a good one.
Tell me about
it. And this is going to be at Sundance?
Yeah. So we're premiering our world premiere at Sundance in the U.S. dramatic competition. So we're one of 10 films that's basically competing for the grand jury prize, which is really, really exciting. And yeah, Rebecca, she's just a total pro and a doll and just so talented in so many regards, and just getting to work with her and just veterans of the industry like Tessa and Andre Holland and Ruth Negga. It was so, so amazing. So I'm thrilled. I can't wait to see it and for everyone to see it. Yeah.
So how did you make the transition from bassist to music supervisor?
Well, I'd always been fascinated with the role of music supervisor even before I knew that it was a job. I'd always mm-hmm. been very obsessed with watching film and TV and knowing where the music came from. And I would have very specific songs in my mind from different movies, you know, and forever I will associate those together. I think I was talking to someone the other day about The Wedding Singer and how China Girl by David Bowie, that scene, I will always associate those two together with Drew Barrymore singing that. So I always, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Exactly.
No, I mean, it's funny when you're introduced through a song, through a film, you know, especially when you're kind of growing up, you sort of think the song was created for the movie, you know, and a lot of times it's funny you bring up like David Bowie. I'm sure the first time I heard like Let's Dance, I thought it was written for the movie that I saw it in, you know, or there's all these, you know, go back to Scorsese, all these songs where it's like, what are the Rolling Stones? Oh, they're the Goodfellas band. Oh, they're a band. Oh, okay.
Exactly. Oh, they wrote the score to this film. Like, you may have heard of it. Goodfellas?
Yeah.
Casino? Yeah. Anybody? It's so, you're totally right.
That's one of the more frustrating things that composers go through is when you're showing your friends your movie and they start playing a song and your friends look over and they say, did you write this? And you say, no, that's a different thing. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah. Thanks for rubbing it in. Yeah. Appreciate you.
So on that front, as a supervisor, are you in charge of like as far as licensing any songs and things like that?
Mm-hmm. So in charge of licensing and clearing all the music and basically getting in touch with all the rights owners, which can be very tricky, especially on this film, where we tried to utilize public domain music when we could, just to get creative with the budget and be resourceful because we had certain expenses that we needed to make. But yeah, so public domain can get very, very tricky, we learned. It was a little bit of a nebulous and educational experience at times because there are all these public domain laws that you have to figure out who owns the rights now, 100 or something years later. So you're doing that and then reaching out to each rights owner and working out different licenses with each person and doing all the legal stuff.
For our listeners that don't know, the concept of public domain for music, it gets pretty specific because not only do you have to deal with the rights of the song, you have to deal with the rights of the recording. So if you have something that's, you know, ages old, like Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, if you use a version that was recorded by the San Francisco Symphony last year, the recording is probably copyrighted and you have to license the recording. So there's all these different challenges that luckily as a composer, we usually have clauses built in our contracts that say we're not responsible for all that, but that's something that the music supervisor takes on that responsibility. So that's got to be a little concerning to you.
Yeah.
It seems like that's a lot of pressure.
It was a bit. But so the way we used it in this film was for a scene, what we call the speakeasy scene. It takes place in a speakeasy and there are four musicians on screen doing this very close-up jazz combo. And I was allowed two real musicians. So I called some of my buds who are just excellent jazz players. Like the trumpet player, his name is Josh Evans, and he tours with Christian McBride. He's excellent. So I had two real musicians and two actors. So we pre-recorded our own public domain songs. So talk about the different roles of or responsibilities of a music supervisor. For this, I created our own arrangements, so we didn't have to use someone else's recording. We made it just customized for this scene. So
in that way, it's harder for you, cheaper for them, but also overall probably good because it is unique to the film at that point, right? I mean, it's mm-hmm. kind of customized for this performance.
Yeah, and that's where my musician background, I got to really bring it into that part of it. You know, I made my own arrangements being like, this is where you'll be on screen, so kind of play something here. I had charts for everyone, and it was definitely customized for this scene. I don't know if anyone else will be able to use it unless they're just, you know, but
You never know.
you never know. But that's the way to bring it all full circle. So that was really fun.
So was the entire production done through quarantine, or did it start before COVID hit? Or what was kind of the timeline of the film?
Actually, so we started pre-production when I was working on Bat Outta Hell, funnily enough. But, Yeah, so that was 2019, and then we filmed in the fall of 2019. We kind of were a little bit a ways through post-production when everything shut down, and that kind of harshed our mellow on that, if you will. We just had to do a lot of conference calls, a lot of editing from afar, and it was a lot of remote calling people, and it was pretty insane, but we did it, and it came out beautifully. So maybe it was meant to happen that way, but yeah, it was very tricky.
Yeah, and I imagine there was probably like a period where, you know, you guys had to deal with. I'm sure that this was probably idealized as like a theatrical release back when we had, you know, open theaters, and kind of, I mean, there was probably a period in time where you guys had no idea what was going to happen with this film overall, right?
I mean we hoped that it would be like in the festivals, and luckily that did happen, but yeah, hopefully a theatrical run, but it everything was up in the air for everyone. I mean, it was very hard to predict what would happen. But yeah, Sundance, though, it's like pretty amazing.
Yeah. So I guess the drawback is that you don't get to go to Sundance and see it on the big screen. But the plus side is it is going to be introduced to a wider audience, right? Because it's going to be streamed and available for streaming. Is that right?
Yes. And that is intuitively what you would think, but they're still trying to keep it very art housey. So there are a limited number of tickets available to these screenings. So hopefully after that, it'll be wider released and everyone can see it. And yeah.
Yeah. Have you been to Sundance before?
I've not. And I'm so bummed that I will not be there along with everyone else. We won't be there this year, but it'll be virtual.
You know, they'll probably do something like next year, you know, God willing, we'll be back to normal, where they'll play, you know, some of the, hopefully you guys will win and they'll play like winners of previous years or something like that. And you'll get to see it then. But it's just like LA, but cold. That's all.
Yeah.
You're not.
Exactly. We'll all have our champagne toast from wherever we are in the world together and celebrate at some point. But
so do you still play bass, or are you kind of focusing on the music supervision at this point?
Yeah, I mean right now there's no live performance of any kind, so I'm doing a bit of recording from home, but yeah, I'm very much focused on music supervision, and this film was such an amazing project to be a part of, and I just fell in love with it, and it was really nice to kind of bring my background into it. So for this one scene, we had a huge Cotton Club style big band with about 15 actors, and I kind of advised on the period appropriate instruments like no electric guitar for this. There was one that showed up. I was like, we're in the 20s. No, not right. No Les Paul right now. But on trombone, like I would teach all these actors. I gave them each like about 5 or so minutes of how to hold a trombone or how to play an upright bass or how to sit at the piano, like everything like that, because that's just important to me that everyone kind of looked as if they were playing, you know, and
yeah,
in the film. And
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I think I was watching The Mask back, Jim Carrey's The Mask.
I love it. Another one with incredible musical moments from my childhood that I will never forget.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's a point where it's, you know, the big scene where he first appears on stage singing in the mask form. And, you know, he spins the drummer into like a zoot suit type of guy. And he starts playing the tom solo right on the snare drum. And as a drummer, I'm like, that's not where the four tom is, buddy. Like, come on, somebody should have caught that.
Exactly.
But that bugs me a lot as a drummer when I see him like, hey, like that guy's not left-handed. Why is he playing the drums left-handed? Like, it's
exactly.
Yeah, that kind of stuff bothers me.
Same. And that's why for that speakeasy scene, you know, so the shots were so tight, and you can see the trumpet player's fingerings and breathing even. So I was very particular about wanting that to exactly match up. So that's why it was kind of painstaking to go in and edit each individual track. So the trumpet, clarinet, banjo, and piano to the edit. You know, we kind of reverse engineered it a little bit because of just being in post-production remotely, and it was just some things needed to be retooled, you know. But I wanted to be very precise about that. So everything lines up with his breathing. We made sure soloistically it was kosher, but then also together nothing clashed, and I wanted it to sound very much like a real band that was just improvising, and as you would late night gig after the gig kind of thing.
Yeah, that's funny you bring that up. That's where always going back to Boston, I remember I went to school out there. And there was the.
You go to Berkeley?
No, I went to school down the street from Berkeley at NEC, New England Conservatory.
Ah, yes.
And we had a little rivalry with Berkeley. I think Berkeley's motto when I was there, their slogan was "There's nothing conservatory about it," something like that. So it was there was a big ultimate frisbee game between the NEC musicians that are non-athletic and the Berkeley musicians that are non-athletic. And it was big rivalry.
That's amazing.
Because I'm primarily from a classical background. But when I was out there, I noticed there was these two rather big, kind of high-paying jazz clubs over in Harvard Square. They were in these two hotels. But the jazz musicians that would play those clubs for, like, you know, the 7 o'clock show and then the 11 o'clock show, they would go to this kind of underground speakeasy club in a kind of a rougher part of I think it was Roxbury. And that's where you would, you know, that's where they would, all the jazz cats would be like, you got to go there because that's when they're going to play, you know, the bop stuff. They're not going to play the Take the A Train and stuff like that. They're going to play the hardcore kind of jazz
totally.
Stuff down there. So.
And that's the stuff that I loved getting to, like obviously as a jazz studies major and a bass player, like I knew a bit about how jazz like evolved, you know, as we learned. But in that specific era, it was such a transitional period. So you think of these big cotton club type bands, Duke Ellington, Fletcher Henderson, stuff like that. But then afterwards, people would have these rent parties in Harlem to kind of pay their rent. People would show up and kind of pay a ticket, and that's when all the exploratory jazz would happen, and Louis Armstrong kind of soloistic.
That's kind of when the innovation happened as far as jazz.
Harmonically, yeah. People started experimenting more with techniques, and so we really tried to incorporate that also with the music in the film. And
wow.
I think the only thing that wasn't period specific was what Rebecca wanted for the score, which was a mixture of Dev Hynes, also known as Blood Orange, who he scored, what was that film out last year? It was kind of Bonnie and Clyde-esque, by Lena Waithe.
The Queen and Slim.
Queen
and Slim.
So yeah, there he you composed. Go. Yeah. yes, thank you, Queen and Slim. He composed the music for that. But so he worked on our film also, and then we also had this source cue from this woman named Imahoy, who is a 96-year-old Ethiopian nun who recorded one album in the 60s of just this beautiful rolling kind of bluesy pentatonic piano music before she joined the nunnery and gave it up. But Rebecca was like, I must have this. Like, this inspired me writing the script. This is a huge part of the film, and it won't be the same without it. So that was my first task into getting the music together, the sonic world. And so it was an experience, because, you know, with her spiritual and religious kind of values, they wanted to see everything before they approved it. So we took a giant leap of faith and placed it everywhere that we wanted to, along with Dev's score. And luckily they loved it and they signed off on it. And it was an amazing moment for me. I got a lot off my chest then, but yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably something that music supervisors share with composers. There's a period of time when you finish a cue and you're waiting for it to be approved, where you literally can't do anything because you're waiting. Because, like, even if you change something, it might get approved, it might not get approved, so you don't want to change anything because you might have to change it back or whatnot. But there's this period of time where it's almost like this false relaxation where you're like, oh, I guess I can't do anything until I hear back from this director at 5, and it's 4:30. So I don't know. What do I walk outside? Do I leave my studio? What do
and
I do?
And they're in Jerusalem. So am I keeping my phone on all the time? Am I sleeping at all? No. Am I finding alternatives? And I did all of the above. So basically just to keep us covered for every kind of situation outcome. But luckily, they loved it, and then we had a trumpet player aspect through the score. So the score was three layers. Rebecca wanted to have a kind of off-screen trumpet player character who is a neighbor of one of our main characters, and as kind of a way to evolve the storytelling and the passing of time, she wanted him to start out as a beginner, and then we hear him practicing throughout the film to become a player. So it was an interesting way to bring the story in from the score, and had a Wynton Marsalis track warming up as the temp and worked from there. Yeah.
Wow. Is Rebecca Hall the director? Is she a pretty musical type of person?
Yeah. So her mother, I don't know how many people know this, but she's like a very well-known opera singer. And Rebecca kind of got that gene also. We met actually playing music together.
Wow. How did that come about?
We have a mutual friend named Dan Lipton who actually contributed his piano playing to a bit of the film. But he introduced us and we all kind of got together every time we were up back in town and everyone was back from working on different projects, just as a creative outlet to play all sorts of songs and make our own arrangements of like Nina Simone or Bjork or David Byrne. It was just whatever we felt like. And Rebecca has super eclectic music taste. So she knows what's up. It was very, very fun. But that's how we kind of got into me being the music supervisor for Passing.
Yeah. Well, you definitely have the director in place, and you have the star power in place for this thing. So I'm sure it's gonna do very well at Sundance, and then from there it takes over. And now we're
takeover.
It's funny, we're in this mode where everybody I have on the show, I ask them like about the film coming out, and then I say, so what's the plan for it? And a lot of them don't know. They're like, I don't know if it's going to be, you know, on a streaming platform or if it's going to be in theaters, or a lot of it's just sort of like ethereal. We made a good movie. We're going to see what happens.
Put it out into the world.
And I guess it was kind of that way before COVID too, but.
Yeah, now it's even more nebulous.
Well, again, the film is called Passing. Again, directed by Rebecca Hall. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us today. Do you have any parting thoughts for our listeners? I always ask that, and then I kind of ramble a little bit to kind of give you a chance to think of anything if you don't have any parting thoughts. Otherwise, you can just say bye. So, any parting thoughts for our listeners, Alex?
Well, any parting thoughts? Well, I'll just say this is super, super fun. It was awesome talking to you. And we probably have a bunch of our Broadway compadres in common. If you did American Idiot, I know all those guys too. So we should chat about that.
Well, no, this was an off Broadway production, off like in another state. So.
In Bermuda, got it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. This was super fun.
Yeah, thank you so much. Again, I want to thank Alexandra for being with us today. Again, the film is Passing. And I want to remind all of our listeners to go check out our new Patreon page at patreon.com/hookedonscore, and you can help support the show. So again, thank you, Alexandra, and we will see you next time on another episode of Hooked on Score.
All right, everyone. That's our show. Bye.